Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 90 of Little Things for Bonsai People. Yeah, in episode 90, we're only 10 episodes away from the big 100.
So, very exciting.
The pizza party's coming.
Yes.
And this time I am joined by, if you can't tell, my co-host, Carmen Lesko-Viansky. How's it going today?
It's going fabulous. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Just ran outside to water the garden and the trees, and I'm already sweating, and it's just the morning. So, yep. And got a couple of things to talk about today that I'm actually really into, to believe it or not. Not into the other topics that we talk about, obviously.
I was going to say, I think you're into like most of our topics because it's, you know, bonsai.
It's all bonsai related stuff.
So exciting.
But yeah, today we're going to be talking about, I snuck this one in on you. We're going to be talking about rotating your trees and Kusamono. And Kusamono was actually a requested topic by Justin Dardeen. He's one of our listeners / he volunteers at the nursery a lot and helps me work on trees. And so he shot me a message asking about what is Kusamono. To go into greater detail, we'll talk about also why they're called shikusa, which is the actual name for when they are accompanying a bonsai, so they are Kusamono by themselves. But we're going to go into the details about everything Kusamono. I know Michael has plenty of Kusamono in his collection there that you maintain as well.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of fun stuff. And we'll just talk about their purpose in the bonsai world. But before we get to that, I do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. Head on over there and become a bonsai best bud and hang out in the Discord. And we say all of our shout outs at the end of the episode. So if you would like to hear your name and the long list of bonsai best buds, you can go there. But we always have a featured best bud at the beginning of our episode. It's going to be Ben Crehan. Thank you, Ben, for being awesome and sponsoring us at the $5 level.
And yay, Ben.
And then, of course, we've got our main show sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools, John with Josh of Joshua Roth Tools. Thank you so much for being amazing and, you know, helping us with all the extra expenses of running a podcast show. And then, we have our specimen best buds. Get a shout out on Ryuin and Bill Butler holding it down, the anchor bonsai best bud. And then can't go much further without mentioning our editor, Matt O'Donnell. He makes us sound smart, cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. You can go over to mattodonnell.com and contact him about starting your own podcast show or doing an audio engineering project with him. He's a set basis living in Nashville, Tennessee, and he's all around awesome guy. I say it every single time because it's in the script every single time. I don't know how many times it's been, but it's when I wrote this script probably for like episode 12 or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. He's still pretty awesome. So yeah,
he's always been awesome.
Yeah, it's still warrants saying.
Found out that me and Matt had a really interesting connection. I sent you that picture a little while back. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah.
I'm going to put it out there that we both apparently listened to the Insane Clown Posse in high school. But it was also related to professional wrestling. So if you guys are familiar with the world of professional wrestling. And Matt's actually a good bit into it. It's one of his favorite things. And I've
really
guessed that. Yeah.
I never would have guessed. That's amazing.
He's probably sitting behind his computer right now, just
he's
like
going,
gritting
oh
his
God.
Teeth.
He's like, he's just gonna edit this part out. He's like, no, thank you.
I'll leave it up to him if he does or not. But I thought it was a really unique connection because we found a photo of me with my face painted like a clown for Halloween.
I just pulled it up
year.
On my phone. It's amazing. Yeah. I had to look at it again.
Yeah. And then there was also a picture of Matt had like a Dillard's, JCPenney's, like professional photo of him wearing his favorite ICP shirt and holding his favorite albums.
That's so funny.
So awesome.
It's so funny. I love it.
Yeah. But yeah. Thank you, Matt, for being an awesome dude and being real and editing our show. So, and I know I've mentioned in the past that we have t-shirts and stuff on our website, underhillbonsaistore.com. I haven't gotten the new designs up quite yet, but I mean, if you see me or Carmen at conventions in the future, we should have them on hand depending on how many sizes we have left. They are print to demand. Basically, when you guys buy all the sizes, then we print more. So, and they're always unique. So just putting that out there real quick. And just need to mention
we
it.
Should get a t-shirt cannon for Se Bonsai and just like shoot out the t-shirts into the crowd.
I think that's actually going to happen this year. Now that you
really?
Mentioned it.
Oh my God.
I'll have to make it out like out of a potato gun or something. Potato gun. You ever use one of those?
No, but I've heard many, I know many people who have, and I've heard many stories about launching potatoes.
On Little Things for Bonsai People, we always talk about things that are relevant to bonsai by talking about potato launching guns. And Insane Clown Posse, of course. But we do that quite often down here in the American South. We take like a 4-inch pipe and then cap off the end and then put like a spot where you can spray a bunch of hairspray down into like a 1-inch section of it, and you pack the potato in there so tight that it actually causes the pressure behind it to just explode out of there when you light the other end. So
maybe we should do something that doesn't involve actually lighting anything on fire, because you're gonna have some rental stuff there, so you don't want to accidentally explode something.
It's amazing when the potato comes flying out of there, but a t-shirt, I feel like it would be a different kind of thing. I don't want to singe the t-shirt on the way out.
Yeah, it'd be like a flaming t-shirt.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun. Now, I will have to look into t-shirt launching guns. We could always just tape them up into like balls and just throw them off the stage.
Yeah, it's a little less dramatic though.
Yeah, it is. And I feel like the distance, like, because last time we did say Bonsai Lat this passing year, the crowd was not more than like 20 feet away from us. So it's not like if you shoot like a t-shirt over the crowd, it's going to go to the back of the area, probably even hit the trees on display.
It'll give the kids something to do. They'll have to run and fetch the t-shirts.
We'll see. We'll come up with some creative way.
I'm sorry. I'm like in a mood this morning, like a good mood this morning. So I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. But like, do you know the Simpsons episode where Maude gets hit with the t-shirt cannon and dies?
No, I haven't watched enough Simpsons. Me and Caitlin wanted to watch The Simpsons the other day and give it a chance. And she started from like the first season and we have 30
you can't. Don't start with the first season. Start with season 5 or 6.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And then watch through like season 11. And that's really all you need to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing that we talk about often on here is adult cartoons like Futurama, The Simpsons. What else? I mean, those are really it.
Yeah, those are the best ones.
Those are kind of, sorry, Family Guy. American Dad's all right.
Family Guy used to be good, and then now it just didn't really age well.
Well, it picked up again. The newest season that came out, it's not bad. I actually watched it.
Okay.
Kind of funny. I don't know. But anyway, so so rotating our trees. So this is something that I used to mention this a lot on other episodes. Like at the end, I would kind of do like the Bob Barker, like new to your pets kind of quote at the end and be like, rotate your trees. Y'all have a great week. Now, I want to get back to doing that because I feel like it's something that needs to be said all the time. Because like one of the things that we talked about in a previous episode is that if we ever sound like we're repeating ourselves, it's because we need to remind you guys and also ourselves as well to do these things. Because like bonsai should never become an inconsistent thing, but it's also not a scheduled or a rigidly timed thing. So rotating your trees is going to be based off a sense, just like watering your trees. So, you know, so what do you have? What's your 2 cents on that for rotating your trees?
Yeah, we don't rotate everything, but we definitely rotate things that are really dense. And the reason we don't is because we have really good positioning in the garden in a lot of ways, in a lot of the spaces where most things get about equal sun. But anything that's really, really dense will rotate almost weekly. And anything that's weak, we will rotate the weak side towards the better light. And sometimes it'll just be sitting backwards on a bench for most of the season, or it will rotate it half as often or something like that, so that backside really gets more light, or whatever weak part of the tree is needing the light. that's what we do here at the collection. We've got especially the bigger trees on turntables permanently, like a low turntable on the stand so we can rotate them as needed. And usually that's a weekly thing. I've heard of some people who just rotate in the evening when their garden, like professional collections, like when the garden closes, they'll just rotate. But that doesn't give you the same kind of light because you're just getting kind of evening light on the back of your tree at that point. So it's super important to do, especially if you have a really, really dense tree. You want to be sure all parts of that tree are getting equal light. Or if you have a weak spot on your tree, you want to be sure that that spot is getting as much light as it can get to really strengthen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, assuming it's a species that likes light.
Yeah, those are all excellent points. A couple of things that I kind of fail to mention to people, and when I just blatantly just say rotate your trees, because it is, I mean, Carmen put it in a really nice package there, wrapping it up, like as far as like professional collections, I can definitely see that. So if you ever go to like a bonsai museum and you've always wondered how the trees stay so beautifully like full and, you know, healthy, and, you know, it's a combination of, like you said, positioning is really important. So a lot of people ask me about, you know, how much light does my tree need? How often do I need to move it into the shade, or, you know, how, you know, what part of my yard is best for this tree? And that's something that a lot of people will kind of not think about initially when they're putting their collection outside in their yard is, will the sun come up? Because in my yard, I do have it to, let's see, because it's, I'm trying to use common knowledge of how the equator works here. So sun rises in the east and sets in the west. So my garden, it has a long span from east to west. And so the sun will come up, hit them on their, you know, on their east side facing, and then the sun will hit midpoint of the day right over the top of my trees, and then it'll pan over and hit the other side. But right before it hits the other side, we start getting a little bit of shading. So this is kind of it's not a perfect balance of light, but it's more ideal than having your trees tucked up against the side of your house where they only get that east facing, and then the rest of the day, they're just completely in shadow. And then also, like you mentioned, if a tree, and this is something I've seen, just a beginner point that I've seen a lot of people show me this style of bonsai bench. In fact, when I started doing bonsai, my dad helped me actually build my first bonsai benches. And they were based off of this design that we found online where it was like this stadium style bench. I know you've probably seen this before.
Oh, yeah.
It's very common. It's stacked. It looks like you could literally sit on it like you're going to watch like a Little League football game. And your trees will go on there. And it seems like a great idea, but it's kind of counterintuitive because then your trees get in these pockets where there's a big, giant, just blank spot where you can't get light to it, where it's facing against like practically a wall. So I always recommend people, like if they're going to get their first tree and they're going to, some people who want to go in and they want to buy a nice tree. I've had people buy really nice bald cypresses and they ask me, where do I put this? And I always tell them pedestal style stand in a very sunny part of your yard where the sun hits it from all angles. And that usually will do the thing, but rotating that tree. Yeah. Like you said, that does go a long ways. I usually utilize rotating my trees as well for show. If I'm about to show my tree in a, like for instance, I have a lot of elms that I like to show. And one of the things that elms are really good at, but bad about for show is that if they face a certain way for long enough, all their leaves will solar panel and like rotate towards the sun. And that looks good from one angle, but if you don't ever rotate your trees and encourage them to go flat, then you'll never get those flat appearance and like spacing and pads in your tree. And if you ever have to turn your tree around, like this happened to me in a show before, I turned my tree around and my leaves are all tilted the opposite direction. They all look paper thin. You can see right through the whole canopy. It didn't look dense. So
that's a really good point because we're talking about Kusumono today, and that's actually super important when you're showing your Kusumono as well, to have the front of your Kusumono face like before you show your kusumono, place it so that the front that you want is everything's the right direction, because I've seen some kusumono when setting up displays and such where the front of the kusumono, all the flowers and leaves are pointing away from you because the light was coming from the other direction. So this is called phototropism, and most plants will do this. I've even seen pines do it. If you keep them in one spot long enough, their shoots will slowly start to kind of tip to one side. This happens much quicker with herbaceous perennials, annuals, and deciduous trees. But yeah, they'll lean towards the light. So it's really obvious with kusumono. And some species of tree, like you said, so super, super, super important to make sure that it's situated properly before you show it so that everything's actually where you want it to be.
Yeah, with kusumono especially, I've seen this happen where blades of grass, simple plants that have like, and this is a lot of kusumono are like this, where there's like five leaves on the entire plant. If those leaves are positioned a certain way, I've seen like, I'll move one of my kusumono one way just to kind of rotate it a little bit. And then by the end of the day, the foliage is already starting to move. So there's like that whole thing where you've seen that fast, what do they call that? That's a time lapse of plants moving. And if you move a plant, then you can actually see it looks like they're alive and moving. They are alive, but it looks like they're actually moving. And that's true because they are constantly like like little tiny movements. Always.
If you have sunflowers in your yard, watch the head of the sunflower when it blooms, because it will follow the sun throughout the day. It's super bizarre.
Yeah. Hence the name, they call them a sunflower because I've got the sun so much.
I've got orchids and other houseplants that I have to rotate very frequently towards the window and away from the window to readjust how their leaves are growing. So
yeah. So yeah, make sure you rotate your trees. And this goes from underdeveloped bonsai, free bonsai, to fully developed. I think even the more developed they become, rotating becomes more important.
Oh, super important. Especially if you have a really old tree, really old deciduous tree. If it doesn't get rotated, or if there's a spot of it that gets kind of shaded, it's going to get really weak. And it's a lot harder to regrow a branch on an old tree than to just keep it healthy. So I'll do that with trees, you know, under our shade cloth too, because we have them kind of front to back with each other. And occasionally I'll either switch things on the side so their fronts are still facing out, but I'll kind of switch which side of the bench they're on, or I'll just put the back out, which, you know, looks silly. It's like, why are you looking at the back of the tree? But, you know, you have to do what's important for the tree.
That's why another thing, when people ask me if they are like, okay, if it's a pedestal style for your individual trees, what if you do a bench and it's a long, and like, okay, I'm not going to say the type of bench yet. I did, but anyway, it's not that important. I'm like not trying to set up dramatic effect or anything here. It's what it feels like. But no, like they ask me, what kind of table do I set up? And I always tell them to set up a long bench for their bonsai. I have this in my garden, and this is, I mean, I based it off of what I saw at Michael's garden. There's just long benches of bonsai. And so that at any given time, if a tree is rotated, that bench isn't like up against a wall or up against an area where the trees can't be viewed from all sides. So if they ever are rotated, if someone's viewing the garden, they're not going to, like you said, walk around and be like, all these trees are backwards, you know, because when you walk between the aisles of the benches, it makes more sense.
That's something really tricky with collections. When I was visiting the National Collection, they've got most of their trees on turntables so they can rotate them as needed. And it's something to consider when you're at places like a bonsai museum or a collection, that if the tree looks kind of wonky, consider that you may be looking at the back because it may be rotated depending on that tree's needs. At the university, all of our trees are up against backdrops, so walls, so you can see them, but our walls are painted white or like a creamish color. And so they get a lot of reflected light from that, but that's still, even in that case, we still move trees around the garden or rotate them to make sure that they're getting all of the light they need. But having kind of a reflective surface behind them can be helpful as well. I mean, you don't really want to put like a mirror or aluminum foil back there, but like, you know, a nice white, bright backdrop can be helpful. I've even heard of
like bounce UV.
I don't know.
That was my next question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. But it seems to, I haven't seen too many weakening problems. So I think that it helps as opposed to, you know, maybe a different color. I'm not really sure. That's all anecdotal. So I should probably like science that up a little bit. But I have also heard another anecdotal thing that if you put like a pan of water underneath a cascade branch, so like if you have kind of a weak cascade and you put like just a pan of water kind of under it, that the light will reflect up off the water and help that branch out. I don't know if that's true, but I can see where that might be useful to bounce the light up to that branch. I think maybe the increased humidity of that water evaporating,
I was about to say,
would probably maybe be even more helpful than
I think that's the actual
light.
Case.
Yeah, that might actually be the thing. So it's interesting. I'd love to, I should read more about that because that's really an interesting thing to.
I mean, trees also get hot spots as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're sitting outside, that makes sense. If a cascade branch is hanging so low that it seems weak at a point, if it's like at the pot or below the pot, usually that's going to get hot because.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm. It's not close enough to the other parts of the foliage or the interior of the container or above the tree. And those are usually warm spots because the pots will heat up quicker. So, hey, there's a lot of things going on there.
Interesting. I'm going to look at that.
Yep. It's just some things to ponder about that. But let's move on to Kusumono. So
I love Kusumono. They're so fun.
Yeah. I got into bonsai. It's been almost 15 years now when I think about it.
Oh.
Thinking back about the things that I was really into, and I always really did love the thought of accenting plants. And I really, I don't think around the time when I got into this that there was a name for that. Like, it wasn't prevalent. Like, people weren't calling them kusumono yet. They were just saying accents.
Yeah.
And so it was something that I always was playing around with. And it wasn't until recently that I started to really hone in, like, the needs and the wants of what kusumono are. And so it's difficult to explain to people what a kusumono is after explaining to them for hours on end what bonsai is, because it's completely opposite of what we do, how we treat it, what it is. So since you manage so many, do y'all manage some at the university as well?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. We have some there. I'm hoping, I don't know if there have been more created since I've been away, but I'm hoping to improve the collection of kusumono when I go back as well. Now that I feel like because of the quantity and variety of trees that we have, we're going to need more options.
Yep. Yeah. So give you guys a quick little definition. And then we're going to get off into our back and forth discussion like we normally do here. But kusumono is something that, like I said, it's something that has been coming up a lot more recently. We'd like to credit Young Cho for really sharing the knowledge and giving us all the proper etiquette for displaying kusumono. So if you guys are interested in seeing basically... is it okay if I say she's like the John Naka of kusumono?
I think so. Time? She's probably one of the best, if not the best, kusumono artists that I'm aware of. I know there's some other really good ones, but
she's our American, North American.
Yeah, man. she's amazing.
Yep, very very amazing person, very sweet person as well.
Oh, she's so funny. I love her.
Yeah, she's got a great spirit, and you can also see it in her work as well with kusumono. She is very, very playful with her designs.
Really?
So you guys can look up Young. So just the way you would spell Young and then Cho, C-H-O-E, kusumono, K-U-S-A-M-O-N, almost misspelled it. Just Google that real quick, and you'll get brought to her website. You can also look up her Instagram. She posts pretty regularly, and you can kind of get some... some master class examples of kusumono there. But Kusumono is basically a wild grass thing, as the definition, the translation roughly over from Japanese to English. So it is a representation of just something wild. It doesn't have to be grass. It doesn't have to be flowers. It could also be saplings and seedlings of various plants. It could be mosses and lichens. It could be, it doesn't even have to include live things sometimes. It could be deadwood or nurse logs that have things, new things growing off of them. Yeah, Kusumono is just as diverse and as expansive as bonsai, in my opinion. And so Kusumono should also have its own separate display. So when I did Bonsai Central this past time, there was an area for only Kusumono. And it's starting it's starting to become the norm, and I love that.
Me too.
Because there's always been a Suiseki area, so there's always the viewing stone and the Suiseki area that's separate. But Young also did a display at the last nationals that me and you attended. And she did it the year before that. And so she's also curating that whole idea that there should be a separate show for Kusumono, because they stand on their own. They can have display stands. They can have their own accenting Sakusa next to them as well. Like, you have a big Kusumono and then a small one. Like, there's so much variance here. It's just like another level of it's just another Japanese art entirely.
That's one of my favorite things about bonsai, is that every piece of bonsai display is an art in its own right. So the tree, the pot the tree is in, is a whole other art. The stand that the tree is on, the Kusumono pot, the stand the Kusumono's on, the squirrel, you know, every single piece of display has its whole own group of people working to make that art, as you know, the best that they can. And it's so fun to see it all come together.
Next time, if you guys ever get to go to or have been to like the National Show, the Pacific Expo, Bonsai Central, those three shows right now, I don't know, I'm kind of talking out my ass on that one about Pacific Bonsai Expo. Did they have a Kusumono area?
I don't think so, but I know that it was, how you display at the expo is incredibly important. And I do know that if what you have to display is not quite right, they will sometimes take the liberty to make it better.
Yeah.
So a lot of times people bring more than one accent, or, you know, some of the folks running it will bring extras in case something doesn't work quite right. They can switch it out for something that does. So there's very, very high standard with display in that space. I hope maybe someday they'll go into Kusumono as well. But right now, I think their focus is solely on bonsai.
Yeah. And that's the norm. I mean, a lot of people get into bonsai thinking about the trees. And then as you go down the line, and I'm, like I was mentioning my little story earlier that I told about getting into this early on and noticing the accent or the Kusumono or the Shikusa, is that there, I'm very detail oriented when it comes to that type of stuff. So when I would see the display, I'm like, where are all these other components at? So I was asking that question early on, where some people don't, and that's just that doesn't mean that they're not good at it. It's just not as analytical, I guess. But I've also seen accenting plants grown in a container with the bonsai. And we're kind of pushing like a almost a Beijing kind of quality at that point, but it's debatable, because I've seen high quality bonsai have stuff like a fern or a low-lying flowering plant of some kind in the pot as well.
I've seen that work, and I've seen that really not work. So it's kind of the difference of placement. Is it purposeful, or is it just a weed?
Sometimes it does look like just a weed.
Sometimes it is just a weed that just grew there, but it works, so you leave it.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
I have these little tiny ferns that grow here in Louisiana. They're not wood ferns, because wood ferns get enormous. But there's these little tiny ones that get, I think they're like 5 inches at the most if you let them go unchecked. But if you cut them and then you kind of like, and I'm also fertilizing some of my trees with
with organic where they just don't grow as enormous. Mm-hmm. So I do get, like, on my bald cypresses, I get these little primordial looking ferns pop out the side.
Nice.
So that, it's got to be very subtle though.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
send me a picture. I want to see what fern that is when you, when you get a chance.
It's probably something real basic, but yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I've also got this other species of plant that's not a fern, but it looks like a fern. It lays really low. I keep forgetting the name of it. It's very common. You can buy it at a lot of garden centers. I'll send you a picture of that later, but those grow everywhere here because they're kind of invasive, but those look okay. They do take over if you don't maintain them. But yeah, usually best case scenario, if you're going to display your bonsai for the first time, do not try to show accenting plants in your container because it just looks messy. And not saying that you can't do it and that you wouldn't be capable. It's just for a recommendation for beginners displaying, you want to really kind of separate every element of your display because the bonsai is the tree. It's the thing that gets framed as the spirit of the old man or the mountain scene or really close forest scene or something. And then to tell the story, the sikusa is what tells the rest of the story. That's the ground. That's what's on the ground next to the bonsai. So that's why the element's important that it's completely separated. So for instance, if I'm like, this is something I do a lot. This is what I do for my bald cypresses. Because I mean, come on, I talk about them nonstop and it's kind of my thing.
I've never heard you talk about bald cypress before.
Great. Yeah. Right. but no, for bald cypresses, I usually, and this is a thing that I do, I almost always use the ground growing native pitcher plants that grow here. Mm-hmm. Because, and that was one of the questions that Justin Darden that submitted this request for this topic. One of his questions was, what's the purpose and how to pair plants with their sikusa? And you notice I'm saying sikusa, which is sikusa, is a separate word from kusamono because it is a accompaniment. Kusamono is the grass thing. The sikusa is the undergrass, is what it translates to. So it is what is on the ground.
Kusamonos generally, we kind of lump them together at this point, but I think generally speaking, kusamono can be shown alone. It's big enough to have the presence of like needing its own display, where shitakusa kind of it is like the accent. And I guess in Japan, they just call everything kusa, which makes it easier.
Because kusa is just like grass.
Kusa. Just get the kusa.
Because kusa is the Japanese word for grass.
Mm-hmm.
So it just makes it a little easier if you're like, why do they keep on saying these words over and over? Japanese, what is that? Because we're not using the kanji or the, you know, or the proper, we're just doing the phonetic for us English speakers. So the kusa is the grass thing. Mm-hmm. So I use the pitcher plants for my bald cypresses for a number of reasons. And this is just an example. Don't go out and buy a bunch of pitcher plants, start displaying them next to your bonsai trees, even though they do make great accents. Mm-hmm. For a great number of reasons, the pitcher plants that I use were locally sourced. So they grow in the bogs and marshes that are here. So they are a pale pitcher. It's a Sarracenia alata or alata for you horticulture nerds out there. I don't know which one you want to say. But it's a pale pitcher. So it is not a very vibrant pitcher. It actually has a green to light green pale top or a hood. It doesn't grow very tall, especially when put into a smaller container. So it can grow up to, I would say, 10, 12 inches at the most in a smaller container. And when I display them next to my bald cypresses, my bald cypresses are tall, lean, chunky looking trees. So the kusamono or the sikusa should never be larger than the bonsai display. Your pot should not be the same size as your bonsai pot. I usually go off of like right under a quarter of like the size of the pot of the bonsai. So
So if your pot is, let's say, like a, I've got a tree out there like in a 20 inch. So a quarter of that would be somewhere around the six, you know, 5-6 inch mark. That's fine. I'm fine with a Kusamono or Shikusa display pot to be that big, but it can't be as imposing. Like, it can't have deep walls. It should be very shallow in comparison. And I might even go a little bit smaller than that, but you don't want your Shikusa to be so small that it just doesn't make an impact. You want it to be big enough that everyone can see it, obviously. And then that's where the pottery side becomes very playful. So just like with Shohin and Mame, you can buy more colorful pots or painted scene pots. Your Shikusa could also have colorful, unique, abstract, primitive, weird shapes that draw the attention to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was leaving some breathing room there because I felt like I was off on a tangent. If you wanted to go in there and say more about size and pottery choice.
Yeah, so it can get complicated, as all things do. And I think if you're planning to show, like if you have one tree that you're planning to show, finding the right size and the right plant is important for that display. When you kind of fall down the Kusamono rabbit hole, you end up with 5, 10, 50, 75 Kusamono in your yard, and you kind of can just pick and choose what looks best. You'll have a variety of sizes, a variety of plants. So you can kind of choose what works best at the time. Size-wise, it's important to not be too big because you want your accent to make your bonsai look bigger, but it's important for it not to be too small because then it's just out of scale. So like with everything in bonsai, you're looking for balance. You don't really want it to be taller than, I think, the lip of your pot when it's up on a stand, I think usually is the rule, but of course that can be flexed.
All the time. Yeah, it's different.
Depending on what you're showing. Because like with a really tall, bald cypress, you know, you may have a shallow pot on a lower stand, and so you may still have a taller accent. So kind of whatever balances out. You want to have a different pot shape and a different pot color than what your tree is in. And you want to be sure you have your accent plant on a either a stand or a jita, which is, you know, your little wooden slab. It has to be on something, just like your bonsai on a stand, just to give it that presence. And to go kind of back off of, you know, what's the purpose of this? It's to tell you, it's like you get to play naturalist, which is really fun. It gives you a chance to tell where your tree is from. So you want a plant or selection of plants that's from, you know, the same ecological habitat. And then they can tell you what season you're in. So if you're in the spring, maybe you have a little accent that has a flower. Or if you're in the fall or the winter, maybe you have grasses that have, you know, died back, but their seed heads are still there. Or you have flowers that have died, but the seed pods are still present. Or you have something with bright red berries, something like that. So it can tell you where you're from, where you are, and what season you're in, as well as giving that scale and kind of additional prominence to your bonsai.
Yep. Well stated on that.
Thank you.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
And one of the things I was going through Bonsai Central critiquing with now, Togatake, he went through and we were looking at a couple of different things as far as what style of stands the Shikusas were on. And he said even the Sikusas have different styles of stands they should be put on to represent the further, like to further represent the seasons even more.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's cool.
I can't remember because it was like there's the bamboo pieces that are like strung together as a mat. He told me that that was a more of a midsummer.
That makes sense to me.
Because
that feels like a very outdoorsy, summery.
Because you want to know why?
Yeah, I do.
That's the time of year that in Japan, they traditionally draw down the bamboo shades to give better comfort during the summer time.
Cool.
So when you see, so it's like in Japanese culture, there's a lot of like little cues and visual cues in bonsai and in display of bonsai that tell you what time of year it is. It could just be based completely off of like the elements used in the display down to the type of wood or the arrangement of the plants. And that's something that over here in North America that we haven't really gotten to yet. But people are experimenting with that. And so if you see something that's a visual cue that is a cultural impact, it can speak much louder than you would think because I don't know.
That's really interesting because I knew that with scrolls, like the phases of the moon in Japan, like certain times of the year, the moon is hazy or there's usually cloud cover or it's totally clear. So depending, like if you have a scroll with a moon on it, there's a very clear winter moon, summer moon, fall or spring moon. Like, whereas, and you know, culturally we wouldn't know that unless we lived in Japan and paid attention to the moon. So that's, it's like one of those really subtle things or like certain birds
show like up during certain times of year.
On a scroll. Yeah. So like you'd have maybe a migrating bird in the spring or something like that. I didn't consider that played all the way down into Kusumono as far as like stand choice. I understood it with the plants, but stand choice, that's really, really interesting. I need to talk to Nao about that. That's cool. Super
and
cool.
If we can get Nao on here, maybe we'll ask him more about symbolism and in that stuff too. I think that is very interesting. And so knowing that symbolism as well, we can even go into it. And if we're ever stumped, pun intended, about what to display alongside our bonsai or how to display them, there are just some, they're not written rules, but they are things that are used in Japanese culture to tell us how to present that piece depending on the year and location. So when we get a little bit more experimental and we're using species and you're not using a shikusa that's necessarily localized to its environment. So you're like, you might be asking yourself, and this is what I do a lot with my trees is I love showing Southeast native plants. So my selection of shikusa is always centered around, it has to be a native plant. That's what I always concentrate on. But what if you're showing a trident maple or a Japanese maple or a Japanese quince or, you know, something that you have no idea what the environment around that would look like. But we do have select garden plants that we can get from garden centers, or even if you're good at cultivating certain types of smaller containerized plants, you might be able to pull that off depending on your skill level with it. Because if you thought, okay, so if you gotten into the bonsai thing and thought that it was difficult to maintain bonsai, Kusumono has a whole other set of care and practice applied to them. So since Carmen has maintained a lot more Kusumono under a heavier, you know, requirement that they all look a certain way, I feel like you can kind of explain the care guide thing a lot better than I could, and I'll kind of bounce off of that.
Sure. To me, Kusumono is much easier because I feel like a lot of people grow plants in pots, whether it's like a tomato plant or like geraniums on your porch. You know, a lot of people have grown just plants. And so I feel like growing Kusumono is much more similar to that. It's much less strict than bonsai watering requirements and fertilizing and all of that. The important thing is to know, does your plant want sun or shade? Because that will determine your placement And if it's water loving or not. So even with the sun plants during, you know, midsummer, we'll shade them just because they're in a small pot and they'll dry out more quickly if they're in too much sun. And with a Acusmono, if it dries out because it's an herbaceous plant, a lot of times it's just like, it's dead. And you either, a lot, sometimes the roots won't be dead, but you'll have to roots might still be alive, but you'll have to regrow the entire top of your plant. So we usually shade them in the summer, but in the spring, especially with sun-loving plants, we keep them in the sun because otherwise you're going to get scraggly, leggy-looking stuff. And then water requirements, you know, stuff like your bog plants, we'll put those in containers that don't even have holes in the bottom and keep them pretty wet. Other things, we'll be sure that they have good drainage and, you know, water them less. So knowing your light requirement and your watering requirement really are the two key things. Fertilizing, you know, we kind of just fertilize them regularly. If you over fertilize, your plant might get too big, but over time, as it becomes more and more root bound in its tiny little container, they'll become more diminutive and smaller just because of that constriction in the pot. And you want that. So unless your plant is really, really weak and really, really suffering, we don't usually repot Acusmono unless we have to, because we want them to kind of become smaller over time. So your grasses might be half the size that they would be in your yard, or we've got columbines now that the leaves are, you know, the size of your pinky finger instead of the size of a quarter. So letting them get root bound is good. And we'll use, you can use regular potting mix. You can use pumice akadama. Sometimes we'll use compost and pumice fines, or compost and pumice and akadama fines. They like it a little bit more organic because they like to stay a little bit wetter than the bonsai do. It's a great way to kind of use up some of the bits and pieces of your soil mix that you otherwise would not find use for in your bonsai.
Yep, exactly. Another well-spoken your care guide on Acusmono.
It's almost like I do this professionally.
Exactly. I didn't want to like step on your toes when it came to that, because okay. I know you have had a lot more experience with larger chunks of collections, where my Acusmono and Setcusa displays are always, they're always like what's looking good at the time because of the nursery environment versus a curated museum environment is different. If it simplifies it for people, it's kind of like, that's why I was mentioning earlier, it's like you thought taking care of a bonsai was complicated. Now you have to balance in your mind, okay, I don't have to be so overbearing with my Acusmono. I can actually take it easy, you know, go a little less extreme. If you're kind of like one of those meticulous people where you pick things apart and everything has to have a meaning, Acusmono takes it even further away, where you're like, I can't micromanage this like a bonsai, where you're wiring branches, trimming it back to certain node spacing to get certain things out of the growth habit of your tree. Acusmono is going to be one of the things that Young Cho has mentioned to me. And then also I've seen her do this on presentations and some live recordings that she's done online. I've watched a lot of her stuff. I love her instruction. Is that Acusmono should not be, it should not be contained in a way where it has to be this one way, because it's going to be a natural cycle where stuff's going to die and regrow throughout the years. So like Michael has that one grass that died and then it lumped on top of itself. And we took pictures of it that one time, and he loves that Acusmono. And so it started out like a flat tray, and then like Young says, it's what if the grass dies and then it comes back and it roots on top of its old organic material, and it gets just like this giant lump, and it just keeps getting taller and crazier and more natural looking. And that's the point, is that Acusmono will never stay the same. It is such a, because the bonsai is much slower to change. Bonsai can change really fast still, but Acusmono it's like an overdrive like change, because in the springtime, you'll have shoots of grass or leaves or stalks or whatever pop up. And then late spring or summer, depending on your flowering time, you'll have flowers and then seed heads, and then stuff dies back. And all this stuff happens sometimes in the matter of days or weeks. It depends on the plant. And then there's also mixed Kusumono displays where there's more than one plant in a pot. So it's not just one particular type of plant. It could be a grass, a fern, and a moss. And all those elements are constantly changing. So it's something that has to kind of cure and kind of become fine like wine as it kind of, it gets older. And you have to live with Kusumono for a long period of time to start to get like the because we get the mochikome. We get the mochikome in bonsai, we can get mochikome in Kusumono. But just like bonsai, they have to be old to really start getting to that place. I mean, people can make really convincing Kusumono 1 year, and then the next year it looks amazing because of things grow in and get spacing, and things feel a little bit more naturally placed because the plants will grow where they want to, as opposed to you planting in them a certain place. So that all plays into Kusumono as well. So any thoughts on that as far as naturalizing Kusumono and the way that they evolve?
Yeah, I think giving them time to fill in and kind of grow in the spaces that they want to be in is really important. And I guess that's one other thing to consider when you're making multiple plant Kusumono, to if you have something that you know is really aggressive, put less of it in, because it will otherwise take over. So if you put a little bit less of it in and a little bit more of your other weaker plants, then hopefully it'll balance itself out. You can always adjust as you go to, if you have a really aggressive grass or something, you can always cut chunks of it out as you need to. We'll even have stuff kind of seed into other Kusumono. So the columbine that we have in the garden, we didn't originally have 10 columbine Kusumono, but now we have at least 10 Kusumono that have columbine in them because of how it seeded itself. So that's something, another thing to consider is if you want to deadhead, so cutting off the dead flowers of your Kusumono, I would encourage you to leave the flowers on into the fall to see what the seed heads look like, because something like columbine has really, really interesting seed heads. But if the seed heads are not interesting, then, you know, cut them off. But until you know what they look like, maybe leave them on your plant. But you might get some volunteers, which can be really fun because that adds another level of naturalization to your Kusumono.
Yep, for sure. So there's, now that we've kind of talked about like the care and placement and the meaning, and we touched lightly on pottery. So if you're ever shopping around at like a bonsai nursery or studio and you see a bunch of misshapen little round pots or oval containers or something that looks like a rock that, you know, has, you know, it's obviously a bonsai pot, but it has a lot of primitive natural elements to it, I would suggest picking those kind of things up, you know, and starting your own Kusumono collection and just experimenting and keeping very much in mind about local environment and plants that you see on a regular basis. So what will grow where you live, like in the ground, just like if people are throwing them in the garden beds or potted plants outside of office buildings or workspaces or whatever. If you're seeing that kind of stuff, those are heavy considerations for a Kusumono planting. And so another thing that's going to kind of come up a little bit is what size is appropriate for Kusumono, because some plants are obviously gigantic and while other ones are dwarf. It's kind of like the whole bonsai tree species selection question is, when are the leaves too big for a bonsai? So typically Kusumono are dwarf, or not always, because some plants that don't appear that they would look good in a pot, and kind of like you said, like the columbines, those are really cool, and we don't get to grow those here in Louisiana, but they have a very unique look to them, and like you said, their leaves can be reduced, which is something that can happen to a lot of other plants as well. So one of the things that I really like down here that grows a lot in our range is daylilies.
And we have a lot of daylilies. In fact, we have daylily clubs and societies. There's so many varieties of them down here. And there are dwarf or miniature daylilies that the grass won't get 3 feet long. Instead, it'll get more. Well, that's more like an iris, but they're more like in the range of like 18 inches long blades. And so the dwarf ones, I've actually had success with dwarf ones where the grass blade will be 6 inches, and the flower, the stem will pop up right above the grass blade, and you'll get this little tiny daylily. And so that is possible. So if you're ever interested in a species for Kusamono or Shitkusa, then look and see, like, you're like, oh, this is a really cool plant. Is there a dwarf or a smaller version of it? So another example of a plant that I use here a lot is dwarf equisetum, or the dwarf horsetail grass. Mm-hmm. Horsetail grass that grows here is invasive. It's big. It looks like it literally looks like a drinking straw. And you have these in Michael's garden as well.
Yeah, we got one on the deck right now.
Yep, they're beautiful, mm-hmm. but they're huge. And so the one that grows here as well, it's the same equisetum, same horsetail. That looks awesome, but it would never be a great Shitkusa next to a bonsai because it's just so big. Mm-hmm. But the dwarf equisetum is Japanese. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily native, but I'm fudging it a little bit because I want equisetum grass next to like my water elms, my, let's say my hornbeams, or my, you know, Acer rubrums look good with those, because I can't get like a horse. I can't get like a cattail grass, because cattail is gigantic, but horsetail grass is very close to that same like marsh wetland feel. Mm-hmm. So those are things you can supplement as well. So if there's a type of grass or flowering plant you're looking to do roses, there's dwarf roses. You don't have to do the big giant crazy looking vine roses or bush roses. There's actually like little like climbing roses and creeping roses that look cool too. Like there's so much variance to this. Mm-hmm. So like I'll go ahead and just give like a list, and you can give your list as well, Carmen, of things that mm-hmm. you can think of. So a list of like Kusamono possibilities. So switchgrass is excellent. Bloodgrass is excellent, like Japanese bloodgrass.
Love Japanese bloodgrass. It's gorgeous.
I don't know if you can get it anymore. I think it was declared like as a non-import to us.
Well, there's enough of it here and it can get kind of invasive. So I think you can still get it.
Yeah. So we also have different varieties of blue stem here.
Oh, so, I love blue stem.
Yeah. People don't think to do it because they're like, oh, that's just a weed, or I need to cut my yard. So I don't. Like, there's a native blue stem that grows here in Louisiana that also is a great Kusamono. Mm-hmm. And you just got to get it in a pot and it will do its thing. It'll dwarf and it'll get those long stems with the little wheat looking seed pod on the end of it. There's also juncus or soft rush that grows in Louisiana that grows along streams and ponds. That is extremely easy to collect. It grows in muck. And I've actually gone out into like a swamp area and saw it like growing next to a pond and scooped it up and put it into a pot, and it just was happy. Mm-hmm. Because it's already growing at what it wants to. It grows in crap soil. I'll as well just scoop it up. You know, so I mean, I've done that too. That's part of the Kusamono conversation too, is people were like, I want to buy this Kusamono. And I always say, how about you buy a accent plant you like? I mean, accent pot you like, and then go collect your Kusamono. That's usually better. And I'll just go down the list some more. Resurrection fern grows here, makes an excellent Kusamono. Ooh. Wood ferns, Chinese ladder fern, that weird little tiny dwarf fern. I'm not sure what it is. I'll have to send it to you. I'm just thinking of natives right now too. Pitcher plants, obviously. Venus fly traps. People don't think to do that. That's native to North Carolina and down. That's actually a native plant. Sundews, another native carnivorous plant that I love to use for accents. Let's see. And then I already said the dwarf equisetum. And then there's also huckleberries that grow here. Jack and the Pollock will every once in a while show up. Depends on what part of the American South you're in. I know that's common where you're at as well. Uh-huh. That's a beautiful plant. Looks like a carnivorous plant, but it's just a weird kind of orchid thing.
Yeah. It's something, it's with the arums or something.
Yeah. Orchids make great accents, obviously. They have to be done a certain way or they just kind of look weird. So you kind of can't be choosy about the type of orchids you find. And then there's just so many other things, like I mentioned earlier, like seedlings, like oak trees don't really, like people don't use like water oak or live oak down here very often for bonsai because of either because water oaks are kind of iffy when it comes to developing them. They have a lot of dieback issues, a weird spacing, internet spacing. So we choose to go with laurel oak instead. Swamp oak is really good for bonsai. But if you get an acorn, like a live oak or a water oak acorn, and it sprouts and you get the seedling and you can leave the acorn with the sprout coming out of it, that makes an amazing kusamono as well, because it tells you the season in Louisiana. That's springtime, you know. Acer rubrum seedlings are the same way. Those sprouting out of a tiny nurse log or just a low-lying grass. There's also a iris here called Naked Lady. It's a spider lily. Sorry. It's a spider lily. It's called Naked Lady because if you look it up, it's a very common like old plantation home flower. So it makes a grass blade that's kind of it's simple. It's just like a regular piece of grass with a white stripe. And then the grass part goes away and it flowers once every 4 or 5 years. And it only makes a red spider lily at the top. And then it goes away and it becomes the grass again. And then those are just some of the plants I'm thinking of that just grow here. There's tick seed. I don't know. Do you guys have tick seed in y'all's range? It's a little yellow flower with brown interior on its, that's a very good kusamono. There's so much. I've even thought about using, I was talking to Caitlin about this yesterday, I think, or a couple of days ago, thinking about using eggplant, like Japanese eggplants, because they have a really interesting flower and the leaves are cool and they come back here. Like they don't completely die off. They keep coming back. Because they get like a woody stem to them. So just use your imagination and let it run wild, and then try other things like hostas or hostas.
Yeah, hostas.
Hostas are great. So, but yeah, what are some wild plants and then recommendations you would give as far as Midwest and stuff?
A lot of the sedges are really nice because they tend to be a little bit smaller than your grasses. So like Penn sedge or, I can't think of any of the other sedges right now. The wild strawberries are fabulous. Columbines, wild ginger, any of the ferns, any of the smaller ferns are really nice. I do like using blue stem, but that's kind of more for a standalone kusamono because those get kind of tall. I'm trying to think what we've got here as well.
There was one I was going to throw in real quick. I almost forgot about. It was lyre leaf sage.
Not familiar with that one.
That's a native here too. It's a type of sage, obviously, but it's got a purple. It's tight on the stem and it comes out to a round shape, like because it's called a lyre, like an instrument, and then it makes a like an imperfect orchid like flower stem as well.
Cool.
Yeah. So yeah.
Any of the violets? There's like 100 billion kinds of violets. We can't believe we forgot to talk about violets. Evan and I had this big text chain going earlier this year about all the violets that we liked. The dwarf irises are really good. A lot of times I'll just go when I'm walking in the woods, if I see a little clump of something that I like, I'll, you know, make a note of it. Or if it's a place where I can collect, I'll grab a little bit of it and grow it out. I've even picked up weeds from the yard that, you know, people are like, ew, a weed. And I'm like, well, that'd be kind of a fun kusamono. I've seen dandelions used. That's really fun. Different oxalises. There's some native oxalis out here in Oregon that's really beautiful. Yeah. So just to name a few, I mean, almost anything you could do.
Yeah. Peruse your like favorite garden center, or like if you have a place, we have a couple of them down here where they're like a little bit more specialized select garden centers where they'll feature exotic or interesting things that you don't typically see. We have a couple of greenhouse type garden centers or nurseries that you can visit. And if you're walking around and you see something, you're like, that looks cool. I wonder what that would look like. Go for it. Now, one of the things that I would kind of not recommend to do is that, like, if you're really into a certain container plant, like, I think one of the biggest offenders would be like a Monstera.
Oh, yeah, that's not going to work.
That's something like that. So we're saying, like, let your imagination run wild and you're like, I'm a foliage plant person. There's a lot of foliage plants out there, but there's some of them that are like the more popular ones I can think of that you see like Instagram influencer plant people use. Sometimes those are kind of pigeonholed in their own kind of like place, but there are some you could use. I'm not saying that those are out of the question.
If you had a big enough tropical and a small enough Monstera, you could make it work. But generally speaking, like, that's too big, too wild, too messy for what we're going for here.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the real big Monstera anyway.
Yeah. Another thing that I see too is that whenever the Kusumono is too, as far as plant selection goes, it's a little too beefy, like like a plant that's got a really thick textured leaf or a leaf that literally is thick. I like it when Kusumono is a little bit more dainty and a little bit more feminine kind of feel. Makes it easier for spacing too. So if you have five leaves on your plant, the negative spacing and the sparseness feels more organic and it feels a lot more believable as opposed to something that's got like a big chunky leaf on it.
It would need a tree strong enough to counter it, and that's kind of hard to find.
Yeah. So, but yeah,
I just want to throw in real quick, because you mentioned it earlier, and I think this is something that kind of came up in a class we were teaching a couple of weeks ago, but you were saying along the lines of, if you have like a Japanese species, but you only have natives, or you don't have a Japanese species of Kusumono to go with it, like, what do you do? And I think that's a great question. And I think that in those cases, like you kind of mentioned, you can kind of fudge it with a native, or when you were saying bald cypress with a non-native, with the Japanese dwarf equisetum, it works reverse too. So if you have a native tree or a non-native tree, and then you use a native plant for your Kusumono, something, so like a trident maple or something like that, if it were a woodland plant or a woodland tree, use something like a fern. It could be a native fern. It doesn't have to be a Japanese fern, but still something, you know, a kind of plant you would find with that kind of tree, but it doesn't necessarily have to be native to that region as long as it's close enough, you know? So like, you wouldn't put like a sedum with a trident maple or with a bald cypress, because you wouldn't find a succulent growing in the swamp or in a woodland like that. But did that make sense? That was very poor delivery.
No. You were kind of going back on that. I could see where you're going. Is this like, don't have any super strict requirements on yourself when you're growing your Kusumono? Because at the end of the day, the Kusumono part is very much for fun. Now there are definitely serious sectors of this, like where like I'm trying to say is it should be taken as seriously as bonsai. But it is a lot more playful because there's just so much more flexibility. Bonsai have stricter rules as far as visual cues for the tree itself. So nabari, takagari, branch structure, and, you know, layout of the canopy, what kind of plant What kind of planting is it? Does it go on in a pot? Does it go on a stone slab? Does it, is it a cascade or is it a forest planting? So those things are in bonsai are a lot more just kind of tied together in a way, I guess you can say, is what I'm trying to say there. Is like with Kusumono, there's a lot more openness, like there's a lot more play in it. So because I'm looking at Young's, if you go kusumonocho.com and just going through one of her galleries and look at the variants in her displays, not a single one of them is alike. So it's not like with bonsai where you're like, okay, here's a juniper with deadwood. What's the shape of the canopy? Kind of a triangle shape. Okay, here's another juniper with deadwood. What's the shape of the, you know, like they don't, you don't see that very often in Kusumono. You don't see repetitiveness where, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing in bonsai to have that triangle shape on a juniper, but it's something we come to expect in some cases. Whereas with Kusumono, we see variants. Wait, I'll even see the same plant, but it's in a different pot. And it could also be a Kokedama, which is something we didn't mention.
Oh, right.
And Kokedama moss balls is what they actually are. You take the same Kusumono planting and instead of putting it in a pot, you build a moss ball around it and that containerizes the planting. And then you put it on a tile, typically. It keeps going. And then nurse logs. That was something that I touched on a little bit. A nurse log could be a Kusumono as well. A nurse log is literally a piece of wood, like a log or a branch you found in the woods that you thought was interesting, has good scale and good character. And you start introducing those elements into it like you would a Kusumono, and then it becomes its own thing as well. So the variance is much higher in Kusumono and display. So any closing remarks on that before we wrap?
I don't think so. I think, well, okay. I said no. And then I'm like, yeah. Go walk around the woods. Go see what you're drawn to. This is a great opportunity to learn what plants are around you every day that you could use. I love just finding a plant I think is interesting and putting it in a pot just so I can... It's like there's a lot of these little plants that go unnoticed, and putting it in a pot by itself, whether or not you end up displaying it with a tree, kind of gives you this new appreciation for some of these little plants that go ignored. So go see what's out there. Go see what's interesting. Learn your local plants. Go for more walks in the woods. Experiment. Try non-traditional containers. Just have fun. It's an opportunity to get to know your plants and enhance your bonsai.
And I will say on the closing remark on that too is don't get discouraged if you collect something and it dies on you.
Oh, it happens all the time. Like I kill so many little plants.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll collect something and be like, that's really interesting. And then it's like literally a seasonal, it's not a perennial. It's just an annual plant. And it just dies. It just, like we were talking about violets. Or Viola, which one?
Violets are perennial. Viola is annual, but it can reseed itself, or if your winter is mild enough, it can be perennial. So
that's where it
depends.
That's where it gets a little complicated. If it reseeds itself, there you go. That's kind of how your Kusumono builds. But just know that there will be dormancy periods for certain plants, or they will just die off. Their life cycle is shorter.
That's a good point to mention, that in the winter, everything will die back. Yep. So don't think it'll die. If it's a perennial, it'll come back. So wait till spring and see if it comes back.
Or one of the best things that I've seen Young do is she'll have a whole Kusumono thing where she'll do like an instruction on how to take care of it. She might do like a revisit on an old Kusumono and she'll say, sometimes things don't work out and... Don't completely let the Kusumono go. If everything dies in it, don't just sit there and like, you know, don't water it and then just let it all die off and let the mosses in your soil just go to waste. Go in and next time, like spring, summer, when you replant, because I mean, she plants Kusumono all time of the year. Go in there and add to it again. Keep adding until something sticks.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to build a custom meadow. If it dies and then you're like, well, screw this thing. And then you get a pot of dried up, dilapidated looking soil on the back of your bench. Then you just, you have to kind of keep going.
Just put something else in there. We have patches in some of ours where stuff hasn't come back. I just pull up a violet from the yard and stick it in there and walk away. And usually it takes hold and fills that spot. So
yeah,
just see, stick a weed in there.
Yep. Or scoop a big clump of now. Okay. And before we close on, I have to say one more thing. The definition of weed is a plant that is growing somewhere where it is not wanted.
Right. So there's not actually any
weeds.
Weeds aren't real. Just like vegetables aren't real. It's just a classification. Anyway.
Yep.
I digress.
Yeah. Don't put all your plants in a box, put them in pots and grow them. So I'm gonna close us out. So go through the list. And like I've said in the past, if you've been a longtime listener, the list order has changed. Don't take any offense to it. It's just I had to reorganize. So going through the list of our patrons, thank you guys so much for supporting us. Every little bit counts and keeps the show running. And so we guys can keep delivering juicy bonsai news and knowledge on a weekly basis to you guys. And if we miss a week, we're sorry. Life happens. Starting off that list with Wallace Woods Pottery, Bonsai Samurai, Radtron Studio, Kyle Ford, Wesley Thompson, Joshua Deminke, David Smith, Eddie Fernandez, Dale, Myrick Bonsai Pottery, Chantel Wynn, Hist Warrior. I get caught up on the Dale thing. Christina Carforia, David J. Boccaccini, Gilbert Hoez, Sean Seaman, Barry's Bonsai, J.M. Stewart Woodworking, Joshua Roth Limited, Nancy Hoffman, Nate Murray, Ben Crean, Victrina Ridgeway, Tim Arsenal, Chris Fossoon, J.S. Potts, Bonsai Marine, A.C. Castle, Louis Torres, Karen Codswell, Austin Atkins, David N., Chase, Taylor Peacock, Greenwich Gardens, Backyard Bonsai Australia, Justin Knight, Joel Jenkins, Ryan Gordando, Snappy Chappers, Joshua Bentley, Ricky Ruins, Boyd Snellgrove, Vicky Off, and Montana Richmond. Specimen Ooh. Best Buds. You always cheer right before we get to the specimen.
Sorry, I always forget. I'll hold my cheers.
But no, the Bonsai Best Buds are just important because there's so many of them. It's like a team of them now. They could Woo-hoo. Take over the world. Thank you guys so much.
Best Buds.
Yeah. And Specimen Best Buds at our $30 level. Thank you guys so much for supporting as long as you have. Unrai UN, Bonsai Garden in Australia. And of course, Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou. Yeah. You guys have a great week. Rotate your plants. And we will check up with you guys on the next one.
Bye.
Oh, we didn't do the closing things. Underhillbonsai.com to go read my articles. Underhill Bonsai Store to go see what we have for sale. There's shirts on our website, Underhill Bonsai Store. Instagram, Facebook, go watch my reels. Mike Lane, go to kitsunebonsai.com. Southeast Florida artist. He does travel and teaches classes all over the United States. Has different offerings, seasonally offerings. He does online classes as well. We love Mike. We miss you, Mike. We'll see you next time. Carmen, where can they check out your stuff?
They can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonsai. And be sure to check out the Purple Pod Society, the National Women's Bonsai Group, to educate and inspire Faster. Women to do bonsai. The end.
Yeah. Becoming Bonsai. Did you say that?
I think so.
Okay.
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonsai.
Okay. I think we hit all the fine points. All right. You guys have a great week.
Bye.